John has, my colleague has already given us a very good introduction to Abraham Kuyper, and very helpful, very very illuminating. And so I don't want to go over a lot of territory to do with Kuyper. I think my role is maybe to look at Kuyper in a different context than the kind of Dutch context that that John spoke to us about. And we could also look at Kuyper in the Canadian context, and one way of doing that might be to do a kind of a study of this institution, because this university was founded by people who were profoundly shaped by the Kuyperian vision. But I want to talk to you in beginning about another institution which was also found with a profoundly Kuyperian vision. And there we go. This is Potchefstroom in the northwest of South Africa. Yeah, one of those lights would be nice so I could read. Yeah, and that's great. That's excellent, yeah. And the first time that I visited Potchefstroom University, I think it was in the early 90s, the sign as you came into the town of Potchefstroom, big banner sign said, said "Welkom by Potchefstroom to Komstad," right? Which in Afrikaans means the city of the future. You know, the person who was with me thought it was a... Nobody here, is anybody here from Potchefstroom? Good. Okay. The person who was with me thought it was probably not intended as a joke, but it is a little bit of a joke because it's a little dorpy, you know, it's a little town with a university, but not just any university. This university is Potchefstroom University for Christian Higher Education, a university which Hendrik Stoker called an Afrikaans People's University, a university that stood for the same principles that our Calvinistic Afrikaans people stand for. Frederick Postma, the first rector of the university, called Potchefstroom a university that lives out of the principle of national consciousness. Remember, this is a Christian university. National consciousness, national loyalty, and love of the nation. Or Chart van der Vault, a university that is unconditionally Christian and unashamedly Afrikaans, this is one of the, I suppose, paradoxes of the Kuyperian tradition, which in some parts of the world has been employed or deployed in very liberating and progressive ways, but in other parts of the world has been employed or deployed in very oppressive ways, but also in some liberating ways, depending who you read. And I think Potchefstroom, even at Potchefstroom, there was always a minority voice amongst the faculty of Potchefstroom, especially at the Institute for Reformational Studies. People like Benny van der Vault and Elaine Boete, who were strong opponents of apartheid at that place. In this talk, I want to give you a very brief outline of the history of South Africa in 5 minutes. See if I can do that. I want to give you a little bit of background so that you have some hooks to hang the ideas on. Then I want to look at Kuyper and South Africa, his relationship to South Africa, and then the way that he was interpreted in the construction of this thing called Christian nationalism. Then look at Kuyper's appropriation within black theology, and finally close with some reflections on Kuyper in South Africa today. So hopefully that's enough to fill the next half an hour or so. So if we look at the early history of South Africa, European settlement... certainly not European visitation. I mean, the first Europeans visited South Africa towards the end of the 15th century. Those were the Portuguese. But the European settlement dates from 1652, when the Dutch East India Company decided that it would be a good idea sailing their ships from, if you imagine, way up about the roof there, that would be the Netherlands, And then right up about there would be Indonesia, which used to be called, I apologize for this, the Dutch East Indies. To establish a stopping point at Cape Town, which is about halfway, and to plant a vegetable garden. And you can actually, if you go to Cape Town, you can actually visit Jan van Riebeck's vegetable garden. It's still producing stuff there. So the Cape was originally envisioned as a stopping point for ships that were traveling between Europe and Indonesia, what we would now call Indonesia. But eventually people looked at the land and they said, hey, this is pretty good farming land. And if we know one thing about the Dutch, we know that they love to farm. With apologies to Dutch people here who don't like to farm. But the interesting thing about, are there people like that? Yeah, okay. Now, these first settlers, they began to farm, and they understood themselves to be Christian and Calvinistic. Interestingly, they weren't very interested in converting the indigenous people to Christianity. The first missionaries actually were Moravians in South Africa, and if you go to the Western Cape, you can visit some of the original mission statements set up by the Moravians. But Christianity was a kind of an identity marker. Okay, what is it that makes us different from the indigenous peoples? It's that we're Christian. So we represent kind of a Christian / European civilization. Well, around 1806, something momentous happens, and that is, as they are wont to do, the British took over. The British took over the Cape in 1806. It had actually gone back and forth over a period of about 10 years. And the British and the Dutch didn't really get along. The British, in their arrogance, thought the Dutch were a little backwards, and some of the Dutch saw this as a kind of an oppression, so they trekked. How many of you are fans of Star Trek? Did you know that the word trek is an Afrikaans word? In fact, you probably have an inner Afrikaner. There are several words in our language that are derived from Afrikaans. Commando, for example, and some others. Trek is one. And the four trekkers trekked into the interior from the Cape into Natal. And as they trekked into the interior, they developed settlements here and there. A kind of a mythology developed a little bit later on about the four trekkers, that they were very strong Calvinists. They believed themselves to be an elect people of God, that God had told them, had called them out from the Cape to go into the interior. Something which is really part of a mythology that was partly created, interestingly enough, by the British, and also by some later Afrikaner poets like Toitsius, the great Afrikaans poet of the early 20th century. The Dutch Reformed Church, for its part, told them not to go. They were forbidden to go, actually, by the Dutch Reformed Church. They were told that they must remain loyal to the British government. And many Afrikaners actually stayed. So by about the middle of the 19th century, you've got Afrikaans settlements in the Western Cape. You've also got settlements in Natal towards the east. And you've got settlements in what would be called the Transvaal and the Orange Free State. And if you look at the map there, you can see those republics. In the meantime, French Huguenots added their blood to the mixture. So did Germans and, interestingly enough, Scottish people. You'll meet Afrikaners if you go to South Africa with the name MacDonald, which is not a particularly Dutch-sounding name at all. towards the end of the 19th century, ethnic mobilization begins. And a key figure, I'll come back to this figure, is J.D. Du Toit, who founds an organization called the Society, the Genootskap van Rechte Afrikaners, the Society of True Afrikaners. And this is an organization that actually tries to create a single Afrikaans identity, uniting the Afrikaners of the Cape with those of the Free State and the Transvaal and Natal as well. So you've got this kind of ethnic mobilization happening. In the churches, the Dutch Reformed Church is also very, very interesting to look at because it carries some of this Orthodox Calvinism, but also has a very strong Scottish piety. So if you go to the great theological seminary at Stellenbosch, you'll see statues of John Murray and Andrew Murray, who was a pastor in that part of the Western Cape and a very important figure in the Dutch Reformed Church. In 1857, a decision was taken by the Cape Synod of the Dutch Reformed Church to permit, owing to the weakness of some, segregated communion. And that practice, of course, if you think about what communion means if you're a Christian, the practice of farmers taking communion with their field laborers is actually quite a powerful symbol, but some people weren't particularly comfortable with, namely the farmers. So it was decided that there could be segregated communion, and that began this idea within the Dutch Reformed Church that while creating a kind of a white unity, it needed to separate itself from its black, indigenous, or mixed race called colored people. So by the 1880s, it was founding separate churches, which were racially or ethnically defined. Well, there wasn't really very much interest in South Africa in the 19th century in the first half. It was, as I said, established as a kind of a stopping point, a halfway point. The British in the 1820s moved some of their excess population to settle there. But in 1867, all of that changed. What happened in 1867? In Kimberley in the Northern Cape, diamonds were discovered. All of a sudden, the British were very interested. And you probably know the name of Cecil John Rhodes and the De Beers Mining Company. Rhodes dreamed of an empire that stretched from the Cape to Cairo at one point. When gold was discovered in the Transvaal in 1885, then the British were very interested, very interested. The problem is that the Transvaal is not in British hands. They tried to annex in 1880, but Transvaalers and Free Staters fiercely independent. So the British try to connive and scheme a way of getting their hands on this gold. So they tried unsuccessfully to engineer a coup in the Transvaal. And finally, they just said, oh, to heck with it. Let's just start a war. The pretext for the what's called the South African War, sometimes called the Boer War, was the mistreatment of blacks in South Africa by the Afrikaners. But everyone knew that it was really a pretext. What they wanted was control of the gold. This war, Abraham Kuyper would call the most iniquitous, or one of the most iniquitous, in the entire history of the 19th century.
What does that mean?
Iniquitous? Bad. Okay. Sinful. Inequity? Bad. Yeah.
As well educated, some words there.
Yeah. Yeah, some of the things that were invented during the South African War were the concentration camp, in which 27,000 Afrikaans, women and children, were killed or died, starvation. Lord Kitchener's scorched earth policy, the idea that when you took over a farm, you didn't just take over the farm, you actually destroyed it completely, burnt it to the ground in case it was ever taken again. I mean, all of these atrocities by Great Britain could be certainly piled up. It was a very, very dirty war. Now Kuyper... Kuiper was keeping his eye on South Africa. Why was he interested in South Africa? Well, there was a sense of historical connection. You know, this idea that that there is a kind of a blood tie between the Dutch in the Netherlands and the Afrikaners in South Africa. Although the Dutch in the 19th century tended not to think very highly of Afrikaners, as far as we know. But Kuiper also looked at what the state of Afrikaners in South Africa actually symbolized. So think about the Netherlands in the 19th century, a tiny people surrounded by the great imperial powers of England and Germany. Just like the Afrikaners, the Boers are surrounded by this imperial power of Great Britain, trying to maintain their sense of distinctiveness, their sense of nationhood, their sense of peoplehood. This kind of imperialistic angle is very, very important in understanding Kuiper's sympathy with the Boers. There was also their Calvinism, and we know that Kuiper was a big fan of Calvinism. In fact, in his, if you want a keynote to finding out what Kuiper's views were on South Africa, there's a piece that he wrote, published in French in 1900, called The South African Crisis. And it's quite instructive. And in that document, he actually goes as far as to say that the soul of the Afrikaners is Calvinism. The soul of the Afrikaners is Calvinism. Now, Kuiper was an Anglophile earlier in life, but he had a strong reaction to Victorian imperialism. And he actually identified imperialism as the desire to make the world into the image of the self. Okay, so the British wanted to see the entire world as an image of Great Britain, and to subordinate and to impose their culture upon the world. And in South Africa, of course, the cultural thing they were trying to impose was this thing called liberalism, about which John has had some things to say. Those who don't fit in are excluded from public life, and Kuiper says that the Boers, because they are different, because they are other, have been made exiles in their own country. Exiles in their own country. Nevertheless, more and more people are in the habit of identifying the British Empire with the Kingdom of God and anglicizing Christ himself. Anglicizing Christ himself. So for Kuiper, the struggle of the Boers in South Africa was, in a sense, the global struggle in microcosm. Those who asserted difference versus those who proclaimed homogenization. The Boers were a people who had been robbed of their independent national existence by the English lust, I quote, for power and conquest. And this is the real thrust, I think, of Kuiper's sympathy for the Boer cause. As I'll talk about, the actual relationship between Kuiper and particular South Africans went sour. A founder of the Genootskap van Rechte Afrikaners, Du Toit, was looking to establish some kind of link with Europe. Okay, so we want to send our pastors to Europe to become educated, and he thought that the Free University would be a really good place to do that. But it turns out that Leiden University gave him a sweeter offer, and Kuiper was rather unhappy about that, about going to a sort of a rival university. Du Toit's passion was for what the political scientist Herman Chelimi has called ethnic mobilization. And key to ethnic mobilization was education. Not only was it important to someone like Du Toit that Kuiper modeled a distinctively Calvinistic education system, but such a system could be a key plank in resisting British dominance. DuToy even went as far as adapting Kuiper's ONCE program, which John and I were talking about at the break. Distinctively Christian programs and principles. But when DuToy talked about distinctively Christian programs and principles, he actually wanted to use that as a basis for developing a single Afrikaner ethnicity. So even as far back as the 1880s, Kuiper's ideas are being interpreted ethnically. Yes. As I said, the South African War was a disaster for Afrikaners. The policies of the British resemble what we would today call genocide. And in the wake of their humiliation in the South African War, the Afrikaners were a beaten-down people, forbidden to speak their own language or to read their own literature. In the words of D.F. Malan, who would go on to become the first prime minister, the first Afrikaner nationalist prime minister of South Africa, they had been reduced to being hewers of wood and drawers of water, like the Gibeonites of the Old Testament. In his poetry, another DuToy, this one, J.D. DuToy, known colloquially as Toitjies, lamented the state of the poor Afrikaners, contrasting them with their glorious past. And here's where we begin to see the mythology of the Great Trek begin to be developed. The idea that that the Four Trekkers did not leave the Cape because their material interests were not being served as subjects of the British, but rather that they heard a call from God. They were like the Israelites of old. God had given them this land and told them that all they needed to do was to go forth and to occupy it. And when the indigenous inhabitants of the land resisted, just like Israel slew the Canaanites, so the Boers slew the indigenous peoples of South Africa. All of this culminates, of course, in December 16th, 1838, which is called the Day of the Covenant, when apparently the Four Trekkers make a deal with God in which they say that, Lord, if you will give us deliverance against Dingaan, the Zulu leader who was surrounding them, we will serve you as a people forever. The covenant at Blood River. All of this begins to become written down as a mythology around this time. Toitjies was a student of Kuiper's. He'd actually studied at the Free University in Amsterdam and was a member of a small Afrikaans Reformed Church called the Gereformeerde Kerke. So it's a very small Reformed Church. The Dutch Reformed Church is much, much bigger. And the Gereformeerde Kerke tends to be situated in the Transvaal, sort of the Western Transvaal. And it was this very small community, sometimes called the Doppers, the Dopper Church, that would nurture Kuiperian Christianity, build Potchefstroom University. If you want to see outstanding work on the Doppers, Irving Hexham's The Irony of Apartheid is very important reading for that. And would provide the impetus to purify the larger Afrikaner community of liberal tendencies in politics and religion. So what was ethnic mobilization in the 1880s under the first DuToy actually becomes almost a program of creating a pure nation, a pure ideology under this whole idea of ethnic specificity and particularity. Toitjies held that God had decreed in creation that a plurality of nations should exist, each maintaining their boundaries. To mingle bloods together was to violate the creation order, which was based on distinction and separation, apartness, or in the later term, apartheid. So God decrees diversity. But within each of those diversities, there is homogeneity. right? I mean, the fact that that the Afrikaners themselves were of mixed blood doesn't really factor into this. Once they have begun to generate as a nation, you have to keep them separate. This is actually something that Kuyper was very strongly opposed to. Kuyper thought that that ethnic mixture was good as part of the kind of process of evolution. But not the Afrikaner nationalists. Hendrik Stoker, who taught at Potsdam University for many years, gave it a more philosophical grounding by talking about the principle of sphere sovereignty. You know, so John explained to us this morning the idea of sphere sovereignty being that you've got these different kind of areas of life, areas of human activity, and they all need to flourish on their own. So schools need to flourish without the interference of
state.
I was going to say the state, right. Yeah, church or state, okay? So schools need to flourish. They need to be sovereign in their own sphere, right? So you need to protect these different spheres and keep them autonomous. Now, Stoker's innovation was to say that, well, there's one sphere that we need to add to this picture, and that's the sphere of culture. Okay? We need to say not only that structural types like schools, universities, churches, states are sovereign in their own sphere, but so are cultures, so are ethnicities. So you have separate spheres and separate streams. The Afrikaner nation being sovereign in its own sphere and having its own calling and function that distinguishes it from other nations. Now, since the cultural understanding of Afrikanerdom was already identified with Calvinism, this meant that the Afrikaners were sovereign in their own sphere in both a religious sense as well as in an ethnic sense. This was not just a theory for Afrikaner society, however, it was a theory for all society. It was a social ontology. So South Africa, in the 1930s and 1940s, is reimagined through this theory as a plurality of peoples or nations. So what you see when you look around you is a sort of a mirror of this theory. So you see that there are not just blacks and whites, but there is a Xhosa nation, there is a Zulu nation, there is a Sotho nation, there is a Shangaan nation, there is a Tswana nation, and so forth. So all of these are nations that need to develop and flourish without being interfered by other people. It was liberalism that actually would hold blacks back.
About 5 minutes, Steve.
Okay. Okay. I guess I spent more than 5 minutes giving you the history. Okay. Right. Now, apartheid South Africa is full of ironies. While Kuyper could complain that the British had excluded Afrikaner voices from public life, making them exiles in their own land, the way that Afrikaners policed the public sphere kept a strong control on who could be heard. So you've got this idea of there being different dangers, you know, the Svartkavar, the black danger, the Rooikavar, the red danger, the Islamzakavar, right, the Islamic danger, you know, and you have to keep these things very, very controlled. You also had to keep the church out of the public sphere, you know, because when churches began to speak out, you know, you've got all kinds of civil society organizations that are excluded because they're marked as being either communist or something subversive. Then churches begin to step to the fore, and we've all seen the pictures of the Anglican Church, Desmond Tutu, and so forth, beginning to protest, and they were immediately silenced by saying that the church should not speak publicly because your sphere is the church. Right? So you speak to your people in the church, but don't speak to us, right? I mean, going along with this was an idea that, well, anyway, the nation is Christian. This is a Christian national state. So if you want to hear a prophetic Christian voice, that's us, We're already in power. My supervisor, John DeGruchy, used to talk about going to the parliament in Cape Town and seeing the prime minister, I think it was B.J. Forster at the time, who would be giving a speech on the floor of parliament. And he would look up occasionally to his brother, who was the moderator of the Dutch Reformed Church. And there would be sort of glances exchanged between the prime minister and the moderator of the Dutch Reformed Church, with the moderator of the church giving approval or disapproval to what was going on the floor of parliament. So it's very interesting. Kind of a formal separation of church and state. But because the church was understood to be also a Volkskerk, right, a church of the people, it kind of had two roles, you know. It had a kind of an organic connection with the people themselves. Anyway, very, very, very quickly, let me say something about the way that Kuiper was used in resistance. And if I could have 4 minutes, that'd be great. Okay.
You got it.
Now, you would think that not just black South Africans, but black reform South Africans would be allergic to Kuiper, but that's not true. Alan Bosak, who is the example that I use here, wrote a book in 1984 called Black and Reform. Now, Bosak had given Kuiper a passing glance in his 1976 book, A Farewell to Innocence, in which he made reference to Kuiper's fiery indignation over the black use of Christianity to support the overthrow of whites. But Bosak came under the influence of Nicholas Wolterstorff at Calvin College in 1980. And from Wolterstorff, he learned about a different Kuiper. This was a Kuiper who was a champion of the little people. This was a Kuiper whose socioeconomic views were radical. This was a Kuiper who said things like, when rich and poor stand opposed to each other, Jesus never takes his stance with the wealthier, but always stands with the poorer. It can never be excused in us that while our Father in heaven wills with divine kindness that an abundance of food comes forth from the ground, through our guilt, this rich bounty should be divided so unequally that while one is surfeited with bread, another goes empty, with empty stomach to his palate, and sometimes must even go without a palate. This was a Kuiper who expressed, 75 years before the term became popular in South Africa, the preferential option for the poor. Okay, so this was a Kuiper that black theologians said is liberating. So you've got these two ways of reading Kuiper in South Africa. On the one hand, used to develop something called Christian nationalism and to protect a privileged class, a privileged elite from criticism and opposition. But you've got another Kuiper who is being used, mobilized to champion justice. And Kuiper's world-forming Christianity and his holism that said not a single square inch of creation, there's not a single square inch of creation that God does not claim as his, was interpreted by Bosak as saying there is not a single aspect of life that God does not call for justice in. That God does not say this needs to be governed by principles of shalom, healing, inclusivity, and salvation. So, the kind of ambiguity of Kuiper might lead us to think that there are almost two Kuipers here. Which one is the real Kuiper? Which one is the genuine Kuiper? If Kuiper could be used to construct a system of good neighborliness, which is a colloquialism for apartheid, right? Apartheid means good neighborliness. That led to exclusion and death for the many and prosperity for the chosen few. Could the same Kuiper be used to mobilize in a way that redefines the neighbor, not as the one sharing the same ethnic blood, but as the vulnerable, as the one with whom Jesus stood? So in black hands, a different Kuiper steps forth, a Kuiper that moves toward a life-giving stance towards the other. This was a Kuiper whose holism proclaimed not the segmenting of society, but justice for all its members. I'll stop there and take questions.